All right, so this is Bio 241. I think I'm recording. I never know with this thing sometimes. All right, Bio 241, and it is August 20th. All right, so I'm going down my list right here. Don't forget SI. That's very helpful to students. Yeah. All right, I got that down here on the list. Okay, so yeah, if I forget, make sure you ask me again. Okay, so don't forget about SI. Oh yeah, the study guide. I want to make sure that you're working on your study guide so that the test is a breeze and fun for you, and that just doesn't beat you up. All right, the website for practice. You have the website in your textbook. Oh yeah, I see a question up there. You know, I don't have any for you, but I've got some for some chapters, but not all the chapters. Now, did you find that helpful in anatomy?
Yeah.
Yeah? Okay. I'll have to get busy and get some free lecture reading assignments out to you, and then I'll describe to the whole class what that's all about. But that's I find that would be helpful. Okay. Good. Thanks for mentioning that. All right, so going back to the website, I had a couple questions about websites. There's a lot of different URLs in this class, including one for the textbook. And in your textbook, I think it just says mhhe.com. Okay, and if you type that in, you never see it in the URL. It redirects you to another one, which is what you see right up over here. So some people ask me, well, where do I get to the practice quiz questions? And this is where you get to it. And the opening page, right? Sometimes it asks you for, is this the home? Let me go here. Sometimes it asks you for email and password. All right, but you know what? I don't have this as an official part of this class, so you don't need a password to get in here or an email address because I'm not tracking your progress or giving you official quizzes that will count for course points. All right, so these are just self-assessments that won't affect your grade one way or the other. So I don't need to know anything about you when you log into this site. So the way that you log in for your own purposes is just to click resources so you can bypass the login page. Now, if I was going to make this a hybrid course or something, then of course you'd have to log in and get credit for all the work, but this is just for your own education. So click resources, and then you can see all the resources are listed by chapter. So here's multiple choice, here's true, false, here's fill in the blank, and then there's some labeling exercises as well, but mostly what they've done for this is just converted a bunch of anatomy interactive exercises and put it in here. But you guys already know your anatomy. Like, point to your cranial cavity. Point to your cranial cavity. Okay, well, all right. A lot of people did it. Well, if you didn't know where the cranial cavity is, then you might want to work some of these anatomy interactive exercises to help remember where the cranial cavity is. And the vertebral cavity, right, and all those different cavities. All right, so mhhe.com will take you here, and then just hit resources, and you're in. Okay, and you should probably look through all those questions over the weekend. Even if you don't have a lot of time, just break the ice, get in there, start working with it a little bit so that you start working with that information. Okay, now the lectures. Some people wanted to know where I'm going to put the lectures. That's a different website. That is my personal site here at Cypress College. And do I have a URL for that? Ah, right here. Okay. All right, so what class is this? Is that me? Thank you. Okay. See what you guys do to me? Okay, so what class is this? 241. Okay, so what would you do? Left click. All right, so here is, that looks like your textbook, hopefully that you have. If you don't have this one, there are copies in the reserve section, and you want to have this one because this one has the correct figure numbers for exam figures. It has the correct questions at the end of the chapter, for instance, and so you will find the lectures over here. So I have fall and spring. I'll probably delete fall 2008 and start to put fall 2009 in here, so you would click, what is this, a Tuesday, Thursday class. So here are all the WAV files. If you want to archive any of these from a previous semester before I erase them, go ahead, get there, download them. So here is just a WAV file. You need a plugin to play this, like Real Player, Windows Media Player, or whatever. It's a good idea to update a player You know, if you downloaded a Windows Media Player in 1998, you have like version 4.5 or something, and it's up near version 11 right now, maybe even 12. So you might want to update the Media Player to make it current, right, if you're having problems playing. So you can just right-click or left-click on this. If you left-click, you can save target as, download it to your computer. You don't have to access the Internet again because then it will reside on your computer. You can burn it to a CD, download it to an MP3 player or whatever if you want to. And if you have a hearing deficit, okay, you can download the text file right here. So for DSPS purposes, you can read a copy of the lecture if you want to. Most people like to listen to it. Okay, so that's where you're going to find the lectures. All right, sem.cypresscollege.edu/, what is this little symbol right here? What's this little one called?
Tilde.
That's a tilde. Yeah, that's on all the keyboards. Not many people use it. Tilde J. Gober. And that's my website. And then from that website, you can mouse around to wherever you want to get to. Okay? So don't forget about right-clicking. Right? A lot of files you can download to your computer so you can have it mobily if you're not connected to the Internet. Okay. Okay. Any other questions? Any other questions? Yeah. Right.
Yes,
yeah. Absolutely. I'm so sorry to do that. I would say we could take a vote, but since my boss sent me a number of emails that we can't allow unregistered students in class, okay, I just ask for your forgiveness and hopefully we'll see you soon in here. Okay? Okay. Oh, yeah, another question. Good. Uh-huh. Yeah. So if you missed the lab, the first lab, you're dropped from the class, unfortunately, as a no-show.
And this class also?
And this class as well. You have to petition a way to get in.
So what should you say?
Since you're not registered, you have to leave. Yeah. You have to find a way into class. You have to replace a no-show from the lab that's right after this class. Or maybe a lab instructor will give you an ad code for maybe Monday or Tuesday or Wednesday.
So
yeah.
Right,
so if you're not registered, yeah, please. Only officially registered students in class. Okay? So I'm really sorry that that happened. Yeah. Oh, yeah, okay. Okay. All right, so let's finish up chapter 1. And I think I have to lecture from down here, so hopefully you all can hear me, because I can't really see the screen from a reasonable point in the room. All right, and one thing that I forgot last time was a sign-in sheet. All right, so I'm going to pass around a sign-in sheet right now, so forget the quiz. You don't have to take this quiz I'm passing around. Okay, this is quiz number 14. So this is Bio 241, and it's August 20th, 09. Sorry, this is all... The nice thing about these WAV files is that it's random access. You can skip anywhere in the WAV file. You don't have to listen to this, right? You can go right to the information that you want. It's not like a... Did anybody ever use a tape?
Hey.
Maybe. Good, I'm glad. All right, so sign in. Pass this around, please, and then bring it down to the front. I've only got one piece of paper right here, so write your name really small. Put this here. All right, now, so with regard to the lecture, with regard to our lecture, we were talking about homeostasis, and you have that in lab. You know, I didn't have time to hook up a microphone, but I'm going to see if I can hook up a microphone here. You spend the first lab period on homeostasis, and we talked a little bit about it. It's a complicated concept. It's going to probably take a couple weeks for your understanding to evolve and really appreciate what's going on, even though we talk about it in lab and lecture. But anyway, does anybody have a question on homeostasis? And the best way, I think, to understand homeostasis is to have ingrained in your mind a flow diagram of what a feedback loop is all about. Okay, and so I think we were talking about that Last time, this is where we're starting, right up over here. All right. So here is a response loop. All right. So you should have that response loop just ingrained in your mind. All right. So what does a response loop always start with?
Stimulus.
Stimulus, and it always ends in a response, right? And we talked about two different kinds of effectors that can produce a response. What, there's somatic effectors versus autonomic effectors. Somatic just means, does anybody remember what somatic means? It means voluntary. So what is the only thing you have voluntary control of in your body?
Skeletal muscle.
That's it. Everything else is taken care of automatically or autonomically, right? So what are the effectors for the autonomic nervous system? Okay, glands, cardiac muscle, smooth muscle. That's it. Okay. So these all are operated by response loops. They always start with a stimulus, end in a response. All right, so you should know the different steps of this response loop. So stimulus will pick up some kind of energy modality, like if it's a photon, what kind of, so if the stimulus is a photon, what do you need to perceive that photon? Does anybody know what a photon is? It's light. So what kind of receptors, okay, can understand or be sensitive to light? Your eyes, that's right. So you need receptor. In this particular case, you need eyes, right? And then the eyes send electrical information to the brain for your appreciation. How does it get to the brain? An afferent pathway. And in the brain, there is an integration center. This is a marvelous little device right here. Because let's just say that maybe instead of light, all right, let's talk about temperature. What do you need to sense temperature? Thermoreceptor. Yeah, you have temperature receptors in various parts of your body. Okay. And as a matter of fact, you have temperature receptors where? If I take an ice cube and put it on your belly button, can you feel it? Back of your neck, your elbow, okay, your kneecap. Yeah, they're everywhere, right? You have thermoreceptors everywhere, so that's a nice general sense. And those receptors will send information to the integration center. The integration center right here has a couple of real important jobs. It has to analyze the information. It's going to take a temperature measurement from someplace in your body and compare it to something that resides in the integration center, which is the normal value for temperature. What do we call that? In a response loop. That is the set point, right? And if the temperature of your body is equal to the set point, what does the integration center know? That there's no error, that you're completely healthy, and so it really doesn't have to make a decision on what to do. Its decision is just to let you go about your everyday business because everything's perfect. But if you start exercising and your temperature goes up, and the information is sent to the integration center, says your body temperature is increasing. Now the integration center compares it to the set point, and what does it see? It sees an error, and then it goes, well, I got to correct this error because I don't want you to go into a diseased state. So it makes a decision on what to do, and it sends that decision out through an efferent pathway to an effector someplace that is going to lower your body temperature. Okay, and so then the effector produces a response. The response always feeds back to the stimulus. Now this is important to see. It feeds back to the stimulus, and it can feed back in one of two ways. What are the two ways that it can feed back to the initial stimulus? It can add to it or subtract from it, right? And if it adds to it, we call that positive feedback, right, because it's a positive sign. If it subtracts from the stimulus, that's a minus sign, so that's a negative feedback. And then the other thing that you should just automatically know, and maybe it's obvious, which one is the kind of feedback that normally produces a healthy state? Is it the negative feedback or positive feedback? It's got to be the negative, right? And because if it was positive, right, if it fed back positively, what would happen? Let's take it from the top. If your body temperature increased, it would run through this response loop. It would produce a response that increased your temperature even further. All right, so what would happen? Your body would be driven away from the set point, and you would go into hyperthermia or hypothermia, depending on the circumstance. All right, so positive feedback drives you away from the set point, which is the normal value. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
It would make your body colder. Yeah, so you would get colder, and then if it fed back positively again, you'd get colder, and then colder and colder and colder, and then finally you just freeze. Okay. Or if you went the other way, if it was positive feedback when your body temperature increased, positive feedback means that your temperature would increase even more, and the loop would work again, and your body would increase some more, and then, of course, then you would die of hyperthermia, heat exhaustion. Usually is due to fluid balance in your body. You become dehydrated, okay? And I don't have names of this, but that happens to a number of athletes in the United States every year, usually right around this time of year, and it's due to football players when they get back out on the practice field, and maybe they have two workouts a day or something, and they maybe go through a gallon of water. Right, they don't replace those fluids and electrolytes, and their body loses the ability to cool itself, and they die of hyperthermia. And that happens with high school athletes and college athletes and even professional athletes, okay, because they just are exercising so strenuously, right, and they all want to impress their coaches to make the team, and for some reason they get behind in their water replacement and their temperature goes up, and it's actually even hard to save somebody's life. Even though we know how to protect against it, that can be pretty dangerous. Okay, so negative feedback is the kind of response that drives you back down toward the set point, and that's a normal, healthy, everyday occurrence. All right, so you can fill this slide in, so I'll just skip over that one. All right, so negative feedback, body mechanism by which any change from an ideal normal value is made what? It's actually made smaller. So when there's a change in your body from normal, negative feedback minimizes that change. It drives it back down toward the set point. It's made smaller or resisted. Negative feedback leads to a compensated state. That's good when you can compensate. All right? And that's a healthy state. That maintains homeostasis. So negative feedback loops do what? They maintain homeostasis. All right, the response subtracts from the stimulus, moving the system back to the set point. And positive feedback, right, is the other circumstance where some kind of response, right, adds to the stimulus. And that parameter is driven farther and farther away from set point. And in pathological conditions, which is mostly what happens during positive feedback, that could be a fatal process, like, for instance, in hyperthermia. Okay. There are a couple different regulatory mechanisms that we talk about in here. Some are what we call intrinsic mechanisms. Intrinsic mechanisms are response loops that take place within the organ that is being regulated. A good example of this is the Frank-Starling law, which we're going to talk about when we get into the cardiovascular system. The Frank-Starling law just says that the force of contraction of your heart is regulated by how much blood flows back into it. All right, so that as more blood is presented to the heart to pump, the efficiency of the heart actually increases, so that when the blood gets back to it, the heart is strong enough to pump it out. All right, it doesn't get weaker when more blood gets put back into the heart. So as the heart stretches out, the heart contracts with more vigor to pump the blood out. So that's an intrinsic mechanism because it's just a property of the heart itself. It has nothing to do with any kind of reflexes involving the brain or hormones or anything like that. It's just a property of the heart. As the heart stretches, it gets stronger. So that's real important in how we treat a lot of people. And I'll have to tell you some more about that when we get into the cardiovascular system, not today. All right, so intrinsic means a property of just the organ by itself. But if it is extrinsic, the control comes from outside of the organ. It's going to rely maybe on an endocrine system. It might rely on parts of the nervous system, including the brain or spinal cord. So, for instance, here is a pretty good understanding of an extrinsic mechanism. Again, we can think of body temperature. right? So normal, let's just say, is 37 degrees Celsius, and as you become cooler, then some mechanisms will be employed. The integration center is going to say, oh, your body is cooling down. Let's change that. What are we going to do? I'm going to send some signals out to some skeletal muscles, and you're going to start to shiver, all right? And that produces heat, and that brings your body temperature back up, all right? So where you have this thermal receptor is in the brain, but what is compensating for a decrease in temperature of the brain? It's going to be skeletal muscles, right? So something outside the brain is adjusting for a decrease in body temperature. All right. Now, on this particular slide, let me read this question right here. What type of feedback is operating in the above example? Here we see a deviation from normal, but then after a while, what happens to that deviation? It's resisted and it's reversed, and the temperature goes back to normal. So what kind of feedback's working there, positive or negative? That's negative feedback, right? That's driving the system back toward the set point. And there could be a little bit of an overshoot right here, right? And as your body temperature increases, how is your body going to compensate? You're going to start to sweat, okay? And again, where do you sweat? You don't sweat inside your brain where the temperature is changing. You sweat on the surface of your what? Skin. What's that? Integument. Yes, on the surface of your integument. Very good. Okay. And so again, your integument is not in your brain, right? So this is extrinsic mechanism. And you see your temperature fluctuates within this normal range. And so what is this mechanism maintaining? It's maintaining homeostasis, right, as a result of that. So that's how you would use some of these concepts. So remember, homeostasis is not a flat line, because if anything in your body is a flat line, all right, you're dead. Right, so homeostasis is what? It's a dance of all different kinds of things. Everything is changing all the time so that nothing varies in large degrees. Everything changes within a way that's suitable to support life. That's what homeostasis is. So think of homeostasis as maybe a little dance or something. Another way of thinking about homeostasis, okay, we can take a look at the regulation of blood glucose in somebody's body. It has to be tightly regulated because that's a very important molecule that mitochondria need in order to make ATP. You need ATP? Yeah, you need. How much ATP do you need? A lot, okay? What's one organ that needs a lot of ATP? Okay, yeah, mitochondria. That's a nice organelle. I think of that as an organelle, but I'm thinking like an organ in particular. Like your brain, okay? Your brain and your heart, kidney. But your brain is real important because that's what maintains consciousness. So mitochondria need oxygen. And if we ever cut off oxygen to the brain, how long can you maintain consciousness before the brain uses up so much ATP that your brain runs out of energy and you pass out? It's about 3 seconds. Okay, so 3 seconds, that's how much ATP your body needs just to maintain consciousness. All right, now here's another thing that's interesting. If oxygen is deprived from your brain, after a period of time, not only do you lose consciousness, but the brain dies. What does that mean when the brain dies? Can't ever come back to life again, right? So that's a really serious condition. Lose consciousness, you might get consciousness back if oxygen is restored. But once somebody's brain dead, it won't come back. How long can the brain be deprived of oxygen? Okay, so there's a range, right? But again, I just say 3 seconds and you lose consciousness, and 3 seconds your brain dies. So it's really quick, right? So the range is 3 to 6, somewhere in there, all right? And so you need a lot of ATP, and ATP production is generally dependent on having the proper levels of glucose in your blood. Okay, so it is regulated. When somebody has healthy regulation, what do we call it when somebody can't regulate their blood glucose? That's diabetes, right? Diabetes mellitus. Okay. Another way of thinking about how important ATP is that how much ATP do you need for a day's activities? How much? A lot. I like that. That's a good answer. But we can quantify it. We can quantify it. And let's compare it to our body weight. A textbook-sized person is 40 kilograms. Maybe all of us in here are a little bit more than 40 kilograms, okay? But an average textbook size person is 40 kilograms. No, 70, I'm sorry, 70 kilograms, 70 kilograms. Okay, 70 kilograms. All right, and the amount of ATP that you need, I'm sorry to say this, is 40 kilograms. You need 40 kilograms of ATP just to stay alive. So what's 40 compared to 70? It's more than half. You need more than half your body weight in ATP to stay alive. That's incredible. So those mitochondria have a big job to do, right? And those mitochondria depend on oxygen and glucose to make that ATP. So let's look at glucose regulation in the blood. All right? So when you read a graph, what should you always look at first? Look at the axes of the graph to understand what we're trying to accomplish here. So we're going to look at glucose concentration on the vertical axis here in milligrams per deciliter, if you're interested. But it's just glucose concentration in blood versus time. So we're just going to look at a profile of glucose over time in somebody's blood. And we can see that it's, you know, pretty much a little bit under 100 milligrams per deciliter. It fluctuates a little bit. But at this particular point, we inject insulin into somebody, maybe a normal person. And insulin is a passport that allows cells to take up glucose. And since cells now can take up glucose, what happens to glucose in the blood? It drops because all the cells are gobbling up the glucose in the blood because there's insulin present. So blood glucose drops. All right, but now what do we see? We see blood glucose going back up to its normal concentration in the blood. So this insulin injection was a perturbation to the system. All right, your body changed drastically. All right, but in a normal person, what's going to happen to your blood glucose? Other mechanisms are going to take over, like your body's going to stop secreting insulin on its own, and it might start secreting another hormone that will bring blood glucose back up to this normal level right here. So from here to here, what is that example of? Is that positive feedback or negative feedback? It's negative feedback because it's going back to that set point, you know, of about 90 milligrams per deciliter of blood glucose. Okay. But because the pancreas pretty much is responsible for this mechanism right here, because it's the organ in control of insulin and glucagon, this is an extrinsic mechanism. It's not a mechanism that automatically happens just within the blood. You need other organs in your body to take care of it. So it is extrinsic. Right. That's not to say that there aren't some important positive feedback mechanisms that operate in somebody's body. There are a handful. All right. Usually positive feedback produces what kind of state? Yes, a disease state, right? Something away from normal. All right. But in a few circumstances, positive feedback is actually producing a healthy, normal condition for an individual. So positive feedback is used in parts of blood clotting. We're going to look at some blood clotting, and that's real important because when you cut yourself, you want to form a blood clot to stop that bleeding relatively rapidly, or can you wait around for a couple hours? No, you would like for it to be rapid, right? And sometimes rapidity can be produced with positive feedback. So blood clotting, which is a process we call coagulation, uses positive feedback. All right. In women, okay, ovulation is caused by positive feedback in a certain part of the ovulatory cycle. There's a hormone called luteinizing hormone that works on the ovary, and that causes an increase in estrogen, and that increase in estrogen causes an increase in LH, and that increase in LH causes an increase in estrogen, which causes an increase in LH. So that's a positive feedback. LH is driven to an extreme level, and when it hits an extreme level, that causes a release of an oocyte from the ovary. Okay, and that's when that positive feedback loop then stops, right at ovulation. All right, and another important positive feedback mechanism is during parturition, when there's the control between the fetus and the uterus. A couple of hormones. So when the fetus becomes large, it's constrained, it releases stress hormones. Those stress hormones then are monitored in the maternal circulation. The maternal circulation then The organs release oxytocin, and oxytocin causes the uterus to contract. And what happens to the fetus when the uterus contracts? It's what? What happens to its stress level? Its stress level increases, so its stress hormones are increased, right, which then causes an increase in oxytocin from the mom, which increases stress on the fetus because the uterus is contracting. All right, so that's a positive feedback loop, and then all of a sudden there's so much contraction in the uterus that the baby is delivered as a result of that. Okay. All right, so those are some circumstances where positive feedback is normal. Here's a pretty good diagram in your book that shows a nice negative feedback loop, right, which I modified a little bit because they left some things out of it. But what does a response loop always start with? Stimulus, for instance. So we're going to say a fall. When you change body position, even when you're sitting down right now to when you're standing up, your blood pressure is going to drop, right? Especially from lying down to standing up. And your blood pressure is going to fall. And you might lose consciousness because you won't have blood going to the brain, for instance. We call that syncope. And of course, that's dangerous. You don't want to pass out when you're standing up. So in normal circumstances, that decrease in blood pressure is a stimulus. And you have a pressure sensor in your body. What do we call a pressure sensor? Where are some pressure sensors? We mentioned it in lab. If you haven't had lab yet, I don't think you'll know this because we don't really talk about it in anatomy, but they're called baroreceptors, right? A barometer is something that measures pressure, and we have barometers in our body that monitor blood pressure, but they're called baroreceptors, and they're in your neck. So don't press on your neck right here, okay, because you might pass out. And all right, so you have the baroreceptors. That is what? The sensor. Baroreceptors send information to the cardioregulatory center, right? And if you know the name of those nerves, that's really nice. That would be the vagus and the hypoglossal nerve, right? To the cardioregulatory center. And when your blood pressure is dropping, that information is compared to the it's in the medulla. The cardioregulatory center is in the medulla. But what is that actual pressure compared to so that the cardioregulatory center knows that there's an error? The set point. And then the cardioregulatory center says, oh, there's an error. I got to tell your body what to do to bring your blood pressure what? Back up. So it's going to send impulses to the heart in one particular circumstance to increase the force of contraction and heart rate. And that will produce a response which will raise your blood pressure back to normal. All right, so in this particular case, the response does what to the stimulus? Does it add or subtract? It subtracts, so that's a nice negative feedback loop. Okay, so you might really want to understand all the anatomy involved with that too, because that's what you guys did in lab this week. Okay, so let's see, is this an exam figure? Yeah, okay. So make sure you can fill in. I might erase a part of these things in the test and put this on the test, and then you just have to fill in all these things, probably even this minus sign right here. You got to be able to tell me if that's plus or minus, right? So this weekend, get chapter one out of the way. Do it 5 or 6 times, right? Okay. And that will actually make life really easy. I think I got one more slide in this chapter right here, and this is control of blood glucose. We know that insulin is important. But there's actually another hormone that's very important for regulating blood glucose. And this kind of relates to what you cover in lab this week as well. And I make a big deal of this in anatomy. And what allows you, especially tomorrow night, right? You're driving home from happy hour, and you get pulled over by that person in the fancy blue uniform and the badge and the sidearm and the cap, right? And they get you out of the car. And they say, okay, I want you to put your fingertip right on the tip of your nose with your eyes closed, like this, okay? What allows you to do that in terms of control system theory? What kind of control system is allowing you to do that? Okay, one that is under what kind of control? Tonic control or antagonistic control? Now, this is really interesting because what don't you ever want to be to a police officer? Antagonistic. Okay, but here's a circumstance that you have to use what? Really good antagonistic control of your fingertip to place it right on the tip of your nose like this. And so when I say antagonistic, what's happening? Why do we say antagonistic? Because what's happening? What muscles are you using? You're using flexors, your biceps, okay? But if you only had a biceps, what would happen? Oh, you could flip the ticket pad right out of the officer's hand, or you could poke yourself in the eye. What else do you need to have precise control and balance of your fingertip? Not just the biceps, but the triceps as well. All right, so that's what we call antagonistic control, antagonistic motion, right? Flexion versus extension. Your body balances those two mechanisms out perfectly so that you have perfect control as long as you're not intoxicated of your fingertip, right? So antagonistic control is really important in your body, and it's used for all important systems, including the musculoskeletal system. In your car, what kind of antagonistic mechanisms do you need to have in your car so that you have precise control and balance of your car? The brake and gas pedal, right? If you only had a gas pedal, you could get home, hopefully with a little luck, but when you got home, what would you have to do? Well, just wave goodbye. Yeah, you'd have to just wave goodbye because you couldn't stop. All right. So blood glucose is important. Guess what kind of control you think it might have? Antagonistic or tonic, which means it would only have like the biceps for contraction. You should maybe take a guess, antagonistic control. So how many hormones would you need to have antagonistic control of blood glucose? Not just one, but actually two. All right, so one to decrease blood glucose and another to increase blood glucose. Those are always working together to maintain proper glucose levels. All right, so the one that decreases blood glucose is insulin, and the one that increases blood glucose is maybe a hormone you haven't heard before, and that is glucagon. When we get into the endocrine system, we'll see that they both come from the pancreas, a little bit different cells in the pancreas, but these cells can monitor blood glucose. So there are chemoreceptors in the pancreas for monitoring blood glucose. So let's look at a couple circumstances right here. So when somebody's eating, they're in what we call a fed state. When you're in a fed state, you have glucose in your digestive tract. It's absorbed into your bloodstream. So what happens to blood glucose when you eat something? It goes up because you're in a fed state. So blood glucose increases. And the pancreas, of course, has blood going to it. It knows blood glucose is increasing because of the cells in the islets of Langerhans. And as a result, there's a set point right in here. And the pancreas makes the decision, oh, your blood glucose is above normal. I better release a hormone, namely insulin. Insulin's a passport that allows glucose to enter cells. And so cells start to take up glucose from the blood. So what happens to blood glucose? If glucose leaves the blood, the concentration then decreases as a result of that. Okay. And so blood glucose decreases. And that is the response. How does the response relate to the stimulus? In a negative fashion. So this is what kind of feedback loop? Nice negative feedback loop. All right, so here is maybe just a little bit of an insight. If a person is not producing insulin, what is happening to all these cells in your body? If there's no insulin signal, where is glucose trapped? It's trapped in the blood because it can't even enter the cells. So what's happening to all those cells in somebody that's a diabetic? They're starving to death as a result of that. So diabetes mellitus is a terrible, terrible condition. You know anybody with diabetes mellitus, you really got to be supportive of them. Make sure that they control their blood glucose with whatever treatment that they have to do. In some forms can be treated very nicely with insulin and others can't, right? But nonetheless, you really got to help somebody with diabetes because highly metabolic organs like the brain, kidneys, eyes, you know, they slowly die every day if blood glucose is not controlled, all right? All right, let's say now that this particular person's not in the fed state, they're in what kind of state? A fasting state, all right? So they're not absorbing blood glucose from their alimentary canal because there's no glucose to be absorbed right there. So what happens to blood glucose? It starts to decrease. And again, the pancreas knows that. The islets of Langerhans knows that blood glucose is going down. So the pancreas has got to make a decision. Under these circumstances, would we want the pancreas to release insulin? No, because that would drop blood glucose even further, right? All right, and so exactly the same circumstance, if you are a diabetic, would you ever want to take a shot of insulin when you're in a fasted state? No, that will absolutely bottom out your glucose, right? So only when somebody's in a fed state should somebody take insulin. All right, that's one hormone. The other hormone would be glucagon. Glucagon is released from the pancreas, and glucagon works on the liver because we have a storage form of glucose in our liver called glycogen, and it causes the release of glucose, the breakdown of glycogen from the liver. That glucose can be released into the blood. Right here, you see glucose released by the liver into the blood. And what does that do to blood glucose? When it's put in there by the liver, it increases. And how does this response compare to the stimulus? Subtracts from it, so we call that nice negative feedback loop. So as a matter of fact, this might be an exam figure too. I don't know. I don't have the sheet right in front of me. Okay, I think it is too. It's really important. All right, because it gives me a feel for whether or not you really appreciate a response loop. So response loops are real important for maintaining homeostasis, meaning normal levels of temperature, blood pressure, blood glucose, and hundreds of other parameters in our body. And so that's really the basis of this course, to understand these response loops, maybe at a molecular level, to see how they operate. And we talk a little bit about pharmacology here and there to see how we can manipulate these things to help somebody maintain homeostasis. But I think you get a little impression how difficult it is, because when we help somebody that's in a disease state, what do we try to do? We try to help them reestablish the balance between these systems that are working within their body, right? So a good clinician will help a patient basically what? Heal themselves from the inside, help them maintain that balance that should be there. Okay, so that's it for this chapter. Any questions? No? Okay, so read as much on homeostasis as you can from different authors and different perspectives. Okay, that is, let me go, somebody, I'll be right with you. Is it this one right here? Yeah. Okay, so there is a figure in the study guide that's not in your textbook, but I did put it in the lecture notes. But if you want to label your study guide right now, here's that slide. I can put it up here for just a second while I answer another question. Yeah. No. So whatever I show you in class. Yeah, I didn't know those were still on there. The stem cells?
Yeah.
Really good topic. Maybe we'll have some time to talk about stem cells. Yeah. This PowerPoint is in Blackboard. It's in Blackboard under lecture slides, I believe. Okay. So, you know what? I have office hours right after lecture today. If you haven't logged into Blackboard yet, to make sure that you're currently active, make sure you see me. This week, I want to make sure everybody can get into Blackboard to get the study guide and these lecture notes and whatever. So I only provided to you the first lecture. Okay. Or if you want to see how to work with PowerPoint to modify so that you can get maybe 4 slides per page or 2 slides per page to save ink, you know, and save paper too, because you can't print back and front and back. And you know what? I don't think I would print in color because it's just way too expensive. But if you can afford to do that, I suppose that's helpful. But don't forget, I'm colorblind, so color just doesn't help me very much anyway, but it might help you guys. All right. So we want to get to... composition of the body. Okay. All right, chapter 2, everybody. Chapter 2. I really would like a microphone. All right, so it's really important, I think, that you guys get to know other students in this class, get together, work at study guide, and then just quiz each other on questions and say, okay, draw this diagram out. Draw a response loop. And if you can draw a response loop from memory and fill it in, right, when you get a response loop with just blanks in it on a test, it's going to be what? Oh, it's going to be really trivial. Right, so... you might want to really work with each other, introduce each other to yourselves in lab. All right, so this is chemistry. Our first bit in the class, we're going to be talking about chemistry, and I always recommend people have a good background in chemistry before they take physiology, because chemistry is fundamental to physiology, right? Physiology is not fundamental to chemistry. You can learn a lot of chemistry and not know a thing about physiology, but the opposite is not true. So hopefully you know a little bit about chemistry. So we're going to talk about some of these things. The basic building blocks of molecules and chemical bonds. We got to talk about acids, bases, and how we measure acidity in a system, and that's we use a pH scale. And then we finish up talking about some organic molecules, and we have four kinds of organic, actually biological molecules: carbohydrates, lipids, proteins, and nucleic acids. So an important approach in this class is to understand something complicated like human physiology is to start with smaller pieces. So we break something that's very big and large and difficult down into smaller pieces. And I suppose you could think of the smallest piece of your body as being an atom. Okay, so that's why we start with chemistry, just because they're small. And it's the basis of a lot of things. So we're going to start by talking about atomic structure. And if you're really good with chemistry, this is going to be an easy part of the class for you. If you haven't, it will be a little bit more challenging. But a little word of warning, if you have a good chemistry background, since the first test has some chemistry on it, okay, and maybe you can get away with studying for 5 hours before the test because you know this stuff, test number two is not chemistry. All right, don't just study 5 hours for the second test, right, because you're a chemistry expert. That's not going to give you enough study time for the second test. All right, so make sure that you spend whatever time you need to master the material. Okay. All right, so atoms are the smallest units of chemical elements. Good, we have a periodic table here. And atoms are composed of these three different subatomic particles. And they're just called protons, neutrons, and electrons. Protons have a positive electrical charge. Electrons have a negative electrical charge, and neutrons have, even though they're a particle, they have no electrical charge on them whatsoever. All right? And they can reside in different places of an atom. So here we have a model of an atom, and we like to use the solar system model to understand an atom in this class. We have a center particle right here, which we call the nucleus, and outside the nucleus, we have orbitals, or different energy levels. We can call these orbitals or shells. And these subatomic particles, by law, can exist in one of these two places, and only one of two places. So inside the nucleus right here, we can only find protons and neutrons, not electrons. Okay? And in the orbitals or shells, we can find electrons, but no neutrons or protons. So you got to know what place these different particles can exist in. So here is a particular element. We call this one hydrogen. And inside the nucleus, I just see one particle right here. And it is a, I don't know, maybe you can see this color. It looks like this color right here. So that is a proton, right? And so you should maybe say, oh, yeah, what is the charge of this proton right here? It's a positive. As a matter of fact, it's absolutely positive one. And here is an electron in this orbital right here, and it has a charge of negative one. And these charges right here are exactly equal to each other, but opposite. Okay. Now here is something I want to tell you. In these charge terms, opposite charges attract each other. Like charges repel each other. So that's going to be important later on in the class. All right, so here's a hydrogen atom. Okay, a carbon atom right here, if we look and count, we see it has six protons inside the nucleus. And if we count, it also has six neutrons inside the nucleus. And in the orbitals right here, in order for this atom right here to have a neutral charge, no overall charge, if it has six protons in the nucleus, how many electrons should be in these orbitals? It's got to have six as well. And that's what we see right here. Okay, so these are two different elements. A hydrogen is an element. Carbon is an element. They're different from each other. There are numerous kinds of elements, and some are very important for biology and some aren't. You're going to have to know the names of the important elements, which I have in your PowerPoint slides for you, and the chemical symbol for them. So the chemical symbol for hydrogen is really easy. That's just H, okay? And the chemical symbol for carbon is C. And what you'll have on your first test is a periodic table that we have right here. All right, here's a periodic table. I'll provide one for you. All right, and you'll begin to appreciate a little organization of the periodic table. The question I have for you is, what's the difference between hydrogen and carbon? Okay, and what I want you to focus on. And the difference between hydrogen and carbon is just the number of protons that are inside the nucleus. And that's what makes different elements different from each other. And we can see that on the periodic table. So when I say proton, what kind of charge is that? Positive. Where do you find it? In the nucleus, inside the nucleus, right? So that's what makes different atoms different from each other. This first element right here, we see number one. How many protons does it have in the nucleus? Only has one, all right? So we call that hydrogen by definition, and there's the chemical symbol for that. All right, there's another element that has two protons inside the nucleus. Can that be hydrogen? No, because it's got a different number of protons in the nucleus. That's what we call helium. That's up over here. Then there's another one that has three protons. We come back over here, that's lithium, and we see one here with beryllium that's got four. And when beryllium has no charge whatsoever on it, when it's neutral, how many electrons are in the different orbitals? It's got to have four to become electrically neutral. Now, we come back over to here and we see carbon. Okay, and how many protons does it have in the nucleus? Six, right? So carbon is different than any of these other elements right here because it has a different number of protons inside the nucleus, and that number is what we call the atomic number. So elements are different from each other because they have different atomic numbers associated with them. All right, so carbon is an important one. Nitrogen is important for biology. Oxygen is important. Fluorine is not important naturally, but it's placed in a lot of pharmaceutical agents. It's probably a good idea to know something a little bit about fluorine right here. Sodium is real important. How many protons does sodium have? 11, right? Magnesium is important. Potassium is important. What about calcium? Heard of calcium? Yeah. All right, there's 20 protons in the nucleus right here. So on the test, I'll give you a periodic table. I'll hide this one, all right? And I might ask you, how many protons does iron have in the nucleus? Okay? And what that will tell me is that I want you to know the name of the element and what the corresponding chemical symbol is right here. So what's the chemical symbol for iron? That's a trick. I see I up there, but that's not it. It is Fe. Okay? Fe. So we got to look for Fe. And then you can use the table, so you don't have to memorize the atomic number for iron, you just have to know how to use the periodic table a little bit. So here's Fe, it's got 26, it has an atomic number of 26, or 26 protons inside the nucleus. So that's how you would use this periodic table right here. Okay. All right, so here it's got the name of the element and the abbreviation. The chart that I will give you won't have the name. It will just have the abbreviation on it, the chemical symbol, and all that information that you have right there. So you got to know the chemical names of a few important molecules. All right. Let me tell you about some rules, how nature likes to add electrons to these orbitals. Right, the first orbital, well, let's look at carbon. I see two shells. It's got two orbitals right here. It's the inner one is the first orbital, and the outer one is what we call the second orbital. The first orbital can only have two electrons in it, right? No more than that. And the next orbital can have eight electrons in it before an electron has to go to the next orbital. All right, so since carbon has six, the inner shell is filled up too, and then the remainder electrons, which are four, have to go into the outermost shell. And chemistry is the study of how atoms interact with each other. And atoms interact with each other because of these electrons that are in the shells that surround the nucleus. And as a matter of fact, the shells that are chemically reactive are the ones in the outermost shell. All right, so we're going to look primarily at the electrons in the outermost shell. All right, so for carbon, we have four. All right, but what's the maximum number? 8. So carbon is going to be actually looking for 4 electrons from someplace in order to become stable. So a carbon atom by itself, even though it is electrically neutral, it feels unhappy, unsettled, it's not stable because this outer shell right here doesn't have 8 electrons. It only has 4. All right, so that's going to be the basis of chemical reactivity, the formation of chemical substances. So atomic number is the number of protons in the nucleus. Atomic mass is the sum of both protons and neutrons. All right, so in the particular case of hydrogen, atomic mass and atomic number is the same. But in the case of carbon right here, we see that atomic mass and atomic number is not the same because there are neutrons inside the nucleus right here as well. And in this class, I'm hopefully won't talk anything more about neutrons inside the nucleus because that's more the realm of nuclear physics or nuclear chemistry. We use that sometimes because that imparts radioactivity to atoms. We use radioactivity in medicine, but that's really beyond the scope of this class. But just to give you a little understanding of why there are neutrons inside the nucleus is because we said, what about electrical charges? What about like electrical charges? What do? Do they attract each other or repel? They repel each other. But inside the nucleus, look at all those protons. What have we done? We've jammed them all together in a really tight space. What do they want to do? They want to repel each other. Well, how does nature get all those things that want to repel each other to stay in this really small space? You package it with neutrons so that they don't do that. That's why neutrons are in. All right, but that's all we're going to talk about in terms of neutrons in chemistry. All right, so where do we find electrons? In shells or orbitals, right? They're in layers around the nucleus. The number of shells depends on the atomic number. The first two only have 8. Second shell, third shell, right, can have up to 8 electrons. And electrons in the more distant shells have higher energy. These are the ones that are chemically reactive. So those are what we call the valence electrons. They can participate in chemical reactions. So those are the ones that we're going to be looking at. Isotopes are different forms of the same atom. All right, so if it's the same element, what does that mean? They have the same number of protons inside the nucleus, right? They have the same atomic number, but a different number of neutrons inside the nucleus. So they might behave a little bit differently. Those would be isotopes. So these are the elements that I want you to know. So on the test, I want you to know the first two columns. The third column is kind of interesting because it shows you the percentage in your body. But what I really want you to know is the chemical symbol for these various elements right here. And then I'll give you a periodic table on the test, and I could give you a test right now and say, what's the atomic number for S? Or for sulfur? Actually, that's even a better one. I could say, what's the atomic number for sulfur? So you got to know the symbol for sulfur is S. Look it up on the periodic table, and it is 16. I can't see the periodic table. But should I check? Should I double check? Atomic number for sulfur. Okay, right here, 16. Okay, really good. Okay, so that's 3 points on the test. You guys are getting points already. All right, but don't get tricked out on what? F is not iron, it's fluorine. Okay. Copper is not C, it's Cu. All right, cobalt is Co. You don't need much of these elements right here, but you do need some. That's pretty strange for you chemists, probably when you first see that you need a little bit of cobalt in your body, a little bit of chromium, okay, in order to work properly. So make sure you work on these things. Okay, chemical bonds. Chemical bonds are the association between atoms that are in your body. And it's determined by the kinds of electrons that are, where are these electrons? What part of the atom are these electrons in? They're the, okay, you could say shell, but actually, what shell? What shell? Which one? The inner one? The outermost one, which is what we call the valence, right? The valence electrons. That's the outermost shell. All right, so those are the ones we're really interested in. All right, so let's talk about So let's categorize, classify different kinds of chemical bonds. And we're going to know maybe about four different kinds of chemical bonds in here and their relative strengths. What is the strength of that association? That's going to be really important. All right, so a covalent bond occurs when atoms share electrons. So that's the key term. Sharing of electrons, immediately you're going to associate with what kind of bond? A covalent bond. And a covalent bond just so happens to be the strongest kind of bond. So these are actually some of the more difficult to break. But if you do break it, it releases that energy. So if you want a lot of energy, break some covalent bonds and you have a lot of energy available to yourself. So let's look at this atom right here. I just see that it has one proton inside the nucleus. Guess what atom that is, or what element is that?
Hydrogen.
That's hydrogen. And then here I see another hydrogen. And its valence shell, when it's just a single hydrogen by itself, has how many electrons in it when it's by itself? Just one. What does it need to do in order to become stable? It needs to get an electron from some other place, and it can find another electron from another hydrogen element, another hydrogen atom, and these two can come together. If they're put together just the right way, they will share these two electrons. So the top atom will feel like it has two electrons, and the bottom one will feel like it has two electrons, and it becomes more stable as a result of that. So both of these electrons can flow around in this area right over here. So these electrons are being what between the two atoms? They're being shared. So sharing of electrons is a covalent bond. All right, and atoms will share electrons to make the outermost or valence shell seem as if it's filled up to the maximum number. All right, that's the basis of a covalent bond. And what's the relative strength of a covalent bond?
Strong.
Really, really strong. Okay. All right, so in this particular case, we call this a nonpolar covalent bond because these electrons could be found anywhere with equal probability around either atom. All right, so at any particular time, you might find it in any location. Let's talk about a polar covalent bond. And let's build an H2O molecule. What's H2O? Water. Have you ever built an H2O molecule with orbital theory before? Maybe. Okay. Maybe not. Okay, so let's build it. How would we start building a water molecule? Let's start with oxygen. All right, so here we have an oxygen, and I'll draw the nucleus. Can you see that? That's a little bit light. Let's see if I can find a little bit darker. So here's an oxygen, a little bit better. All right, how do I know this is oxygen? How many protons are going to be in here? Okay, you see eight over there? Indeed, so we got eight protons right here. So how many electrons in order for that oxygen to be neutral? It should have eight. All right, so here is the first shell. We've got one, two. We got four more electrons to place someplace. Where do they have to go? Okay, the valence shell. And so there are how many left? One, two, three, four, five, and six. So oxygen is not absolutely stable because it needs two electrons from somebody, okay, to fill this outermost shell. And when we made that H2 molecule on the previous slide, what element likes to share one electron?
Hydrogen.
So let's put a hydrogen here. How many protons? One right here. So it has, all right, a shell with one electron, but let's put it right over here. Probably should have used a different color. Okay. And what do we got over here? Another hydrogen, and here is its valence shell with another electron. So this is, what kind of bond is this when these two electrons are being shared between this hydrogen, this oxygen right here? That's a covalent bond. Okay. And then here we have another covalent bond because there's a hydrogen and there's oxygen. All right. Now in this particular case, these electrons aren't found equally over here by the hydrogen, okay, and the oxygen. They're not shared equally. The oxygen likes to take the electrons away from the hydrogen. All right, so we call this a polar bond, a polar covalent bond. And there are some elements that undergo this polarization, All right, so nitrogen is one, phosphorus is one, sulfur is another one, and oxygen. So what does that mean? You know, if we looked at, this was that H2 molecule with the two electrons in it. Those two electrons could be anywhere. So if you walked up on this hydrogen molecule from this direction, it would have no charge on it because there are two positives and two negatives, right? And the two negatives could go anywhere. If you walked up on the hydrogen from this direction, there would be no charge associated with it, right? So no matter how you look at this hydrogen molecule, it looks like it has no charge on it. But let's look at the water molecule. We said that these electrons that are being shared to form this covalent bond are found mainly where? On the oxygen, okay? And these over here are mainly found on the oxygen. So if you walk up on this water molecule from this direction, what does it look like? Does it look neutral to you, or what do you see first? There are hardly any electrons over here, so what do you see? You see a bit of a positive charge. And if you walk up on this water molecule from this direction, you see a little bit of a positive charge. But if you walk up on it from this direction over here, what do you see? You see a little negative charge. But if you're far away, what does it look like? It looks neutral, right? Because the number of protons is equal to the number of electrons. So even though water is neutral in its overall electrical charge, depending on what area you're talking about, it's going to have a little bit of electrical charge on it. Some parts are going to be a little negative, some are going to be a little positive. And because it's different depending on what end of the molecule you're talking about, then we call that polar. All right, so that's really important for biology, polarity. So I want you to get a good appreciation for that. All right, so what happens if we put another water molecule in here? Will they repel each other, or will they attract each other, or what's going to happen? Will any organization, will it start to organize itself automatically? If we put two water molecules together, all right, so what's the rule for charges? Opposites attract, the same repel each other. So if we put another water molecule in here, all right, so if this end is a little bit negative, we put another water molecule, guess what's going to happen? This negative end is going to be attracted to the positive end of another water molecule. All right, so here is another H2O, like this. So this oxygen is going to be a little negative, the hydrogen is going to be a little positive, and that forms an association right there. So polar covalent bonds are important for forming structures and association relationships in biology. And water is what we call a polar substance because of the nature of these covalent bonds right here, because of the unequal sharing of those electrons. All right, so covalent bonds are sharing of electrons. Okay, and we can have a couple different kinds of covalent bonds. All right, what about ionic bonds? That's another kind. Ionic bonds are a little bit weaker. And does anybody know anything about ions in your body? Are they important? Yeah, sometimes they're called electrolytes because they have electrical charges on them. So an ion is any kind of molecule or atom that has an electrical charge. And they're very important. Who knows the name of an important electrolyte? Sodium is real important, right? You get your blood drawn, sometimes they look at sodium. Potassium, chloride, and even magnesium, okay, are important electrolytes. So how do these come about? All right, let's look at these elements right here. Here's a sodium. The abbreviation for sodium is Na. That's not straightforward. Because it comes from Greek, the Greek word for sodium is natrium. All right, and so that's where Na came from. Okay. How many protons does sodium have? It's got 11, right? And it says it right here. It's got 11. So in order for sodium to be neutral, how many electrons should it have? It should have 11 electrons. So how would you fill up the orbitals? You would put the first two in the the first shell, and then we've got 8 in the outermost shell, so 8 and 2 is 10. And what do you got left over? You got 1 left over, can't go in the second shell, it's got to go in the third shell. So now you have 1 measly lone electron in this outermost shell, so you can imagine how unstable sodium is, because it needs what? It needs 8 over here, or it wants 0. That's another stable state, either 8 or 0. So what do you think would be easier, to get rid of 1 or to find 7 more someplace? All right, just get rid of 1. All right, so that's what sodium is all about. Let's look at another atom, namely chlorine. Can you find chlorine over there? How many what's the atomic number for chlorine? It's got 17. So it's got 17 electrons. Let's fill up the orbitals. The first orbital's got 2. The next one's got 8. All right, so now we're up to 10. All right, so that means there are 7 left. Those all have to go in the outermost orbitals or the outermost shell. But chlorine is missing just 1 electron to become stable. All right, and it just so happens that sodium wants to get rid of 1 to become stable. So this electron from sodium will jump over and fill the spot in this chlorine orbital, and now that forms a nice ionic bond, because both are satisfied, they filled up their outermost orbital, and that forms a bond between them. All right, but that's a very weak bond when that happens. The ionic bonds are very weak, and as a matter of fact, does anybody know what sodium chloride is as a compound? It's just table salt. So if you take some salt that's in your salt shaker and you put it in a glass of water or your tea or coffee or whatever, what happens to it? Does it just sink to the bottom like a rock? Maybe for a second, but then it dissolves right away. All right, because just putting it in water is enough to break that ionic bond, and that chlorine ends up with this extra electron. So when it's floating around in solution, this chlorine, what's the overall charge of this chlorine right here? Since it has gained an electron, it has 1 extra negative charge on it. So it becomes an ion because of this electron. And sodium, of course, becomes an ion, but it's a positive ion. And it can dissolve in water because it has an electrical charge on it. And remember, water has these, little electrical charges on it. So on this end of a water molecule, guess what? Which one of these ions would be attracted to this end of a water molecule? This end is a little negative, so what would be attracted over here? The sodium. Okay, would be attracted here, and chlorine would be attracted to this part of a water molecule, and that really describes why ions like to dissolve in water, because water is a polar solvent, so anything that has charges on it love to dissolve in water. Things that don't have electrical charges on it just ignore water. They want to have nothing to do with water. Those are what we call nonpolar compounds. Nonpolar compounds you're probably familiar with would be things like fats and oils, gasoline and things like that. So you can't get fats off of your clothes if you just put it in water, because those two compounds have two totally different natures because of this basic chemistry right here, and won't dissolve in each other. Okay, before we go, it's time to go, but I got the sign-in sheet. Make sure you sign the sign-in sheet, and remind me to start with this slide right here, okay? And you got to get working on your study guides for the exam. If you don't know where to find them, make sure you let me know, because I got office hours right now.